Good, great. So I've already had a funny morning. I'm staying in a hotel, and you know how sometimes, for who knows what reason, the housekeepers leave on the alarm that's next to the bed, which could be set for any old time? You know, it's like 4 o'clock in the morning, there's a sound, like, and I thought, oh, that's my alarm, you know, and so I turned off my alarm, and the sound kept coming, and then I realized what it was, so I'm like scrambling, I got it off, so of course I slept through my alarm, because my alarm didn't go off, so I'm like, oh, people out there, huh, what are all these people doing in my dream? It's very funny, and I'm a night owl anyway, as I was just telling somebody, and someday, before I retire, I'm going to design a day or a retreat or a seminar on my schedule. We're going to start a little later in the morning, you know, but I'll soon be awake. How many of you, especially the people who are here today for the first time, would call yourself new to loving kindness practice? Okay, so I'll go over some of what I went over yesterday anyway, because all of my meditation training, all of my learning and studying has been in Asia or with Asian teachers, and I'd say the hallmark of pedagogy in those systems is repetition. It's like you hear the same thing again and again and again and again. As frustrating as we find that, it's actually kind of useful. Bless you. Unlike going for novelty or entertainment or something, they're just saying the same thing again. And it tends to register. I remember I went to Burma once. There's a whole teaching in an extremely oversimplified form. It's around how we experience things, you know, and so there are the six sense doors. There's the eye, the ear, the nose, you know, skin for touch sensation and so on. And the mind, which is the sixth sense, experiencing things through the mind. So the six sense doors, there's sense objects. So for the eyes, visual objects. For the ear, it's auditory objects and so on. And the contact between those two is consciousness. So from that model, consciousness is not like a steady state lurking around to experience something. It arises in that moment. So it's one of the ways you could say selflessness is described. Not that we all become a pudding, you know, or a soup, but things work in a way that we don't tend to think they work. We have other ideas about ourselves and about life. Anyway, so I was in Burma once, and the teacher, Sayadaw Pandita, was speaking six nights a week. And we walk in, and he started talking about, like, the eye door and visual sights. So that took six nights, you know, to be as excruciatingly detailed as he was. And so then there's a night off. We come in the next night, and he said, now we're going to talk about hearing. And I thought, no way. He's not going to say exactly the same thing, but using a different example of hearing instead of seeing. Sure enough, six nights later, you know, same excruciating detail. We have a night off. We come and say, now we're going to talk about smelling. I thought, no. You know, so that took as long as you would imagine it took. And it was the same exact thing. Same principles, same model of consciousness, just a different example. But actually, never forgot it either. It just took like the entire trip to Burma. I heard basically one talk, you know. So we tend to do that anyway, so it's different. It's a different way of learning. And in that sense, in that spirit, you know, sometimes people have that feeling very linear kind of model around meditation practice. Like, oh, I started with the breath, it's done. You know, that's like 101. I'm way beyond that now. But we actually always circle back and reinforce just basic stabilization of attention. That's what it is. And then maybe we expand beyond that and we do other things and we look at other things. And then we go back. It's not because we're, you know, needing to do remedial work or something. It's just that's the nature of it. You know, it's not that linear. We don't get beyond different things. So I've been practicing now since January 7th, 1971. So you can do the math. I'm too sleepy. You know, and my very first instruction, the first instruction I ever heard was sit down and feel your breath. And some of these people ask, well, what do you do now when you meditate? And I said, well, you know what? My favorite thing to do is kind of, if I'm not doing something like loving kindness or a particular technique that's specific to that technique, and I'm just practicing awareness, I like kind of going back to my breath, you know, and just doing that. And not always, but it's just reinforcing the foundation, you know, again and again. So it's really a very similar thing. So in that light, let's sit together. And we work implicitly all the time with balance, whether we realize that or not. So the technique we'll use is that foundational one. Just rest your attention on the feeling of the breath. And when you find your attention has wandered, don't worry about it. That's the moment to practice letting go and beginning again. So we let go of whatever's taken us away. Gently let go. And we return our attention to the feeling of the breath. But right away, there's balance that's implicit in our posture. You want some energy in your body, which implies like sitting up straight. But not like so much energy, you're really stiff and uptight. You also want to be just relaxed and feel natural, feel at ease. But not like so relaxed, your waist slumped over. So feel your way into what feels like a balanced posture for you. And you can close your eyes or not. And you can change midway. See if you can find the place where the breath is strongest for you or clearest for you. Maybe that's the nostrils as the air moves in and out. Maybe it's the rising, falling movement of the chest or the abdomen. You just choose a place, bring your attention there and rest. Here too, there's a kind of balance. You don't have to grab onto the breath. It's not going to help. And if you couldn't care less what the breath feels like, I'd kind of mentally come forward a little bit and connect more fully. It's just one breath. And when you find your attention wandering, you get lost in thought, spun out in a fantasy, or you fall asleep, really, don't worry about it. You can notice you've been gone. See if you can let go gently of whatever's taking you away and simply return your attention to the feeling of the breath. Okay, so thank you. As I said yesterday, there's a lot of kind of sneaky self-compassion embedded in that technique, even if it's never spoken about. Because I think really the most and maybe the only really successful way of letting go and starting over is by being kind to yourself. Otherwise, it's just too tempting to go into these enormous rants, you know, about how bad we are and inferior we are and no one else is thinking and all of that. There's almost nothing easier. And so making another choice and having another intention and approaching it in a different way means that self-compassion muscle is going to be building and building. And really, there's a lot hidden in that moment of beginning again, including equanimity. you know, if you completely freak out over what's arising, it's time consuming. You know, and you feel unsettled, you feel out of balance, you feel I can't kind of bring my mind to starting over, I'm too fragmented or whatever. So equanimity means balance, and it's very tied into wisdom. Either it's the sort of spirit or attitude we use to approach our experience so that it leads to more wisdom, or in some context, like with loving kindness and compassion, it's defined as the balance that's born of wisdom. So it means shining the light of wisdom on our compassionate act or our relationship with somebody, something like that, our relationship to ourselves. And we'll go back over both of those in the spirit of repetition. But it means balance. And we are practicing balance in so many ways. I talked about the posture. We're practicing balance in both deepening calm and quiet and tranquility and strengthening alertness and awareness and connection. We're doing both. Otherwise, a meditation would be the same as taking a nap. You know, and it's not quite the same. It's too bad, really. But drink some coffee. And it's not that, you know, both sides or both aspects, the calm, quiet aspect and the alert, interested aspect, are going to be developing all the time at exactly the same pace. It's not the case at all. But sometimes we can sense that we are out of balance in some way. And it's not a bad state. It doesn't mean, you know, we've done wrong in some way. It's just an indication that the other side could probably use some attention. So it's very common, for example, as we continue to practice, as we get more concentrated, to feel like the tranquil, peaceful, concentrated side of things, calm side of things, is cooking. And it may well be cooking at a faster rate than the energy, alertness, investigation side of things. So what happens then is a state that is classically called sinking mind. I call it the ooze. You know, you're just kind of oozing along, and it's like peaceful, you know, it's pleasant, but it's not really very sharp. And again, it's not a bad state, but it's a sign, oh, maybe it's time to pick up energy. You know, because it's not a time to try to deepen tranquility, which is already strong enough, you know, in that moment. So, you know, if you're working with a teacher, they might say, do more walking meditation. Or you might just know that instinctively, you know, like, oh, I think I'm oozing around, you know, maybe I'll do some walking. Or sit with your eyes open. You know, just whatever you know picks up your energy. People stand up. It's one option. If you're doing something like awareness of the breath as the method, you might, if you felt yourself kind of oozing around, choose to do mental noting, like silently be repeating in, out, for example, along with just feeling the breath. At that point, just feeling the breath is more like a lullaby, you know. So, while it's not at all a bad state, if that imbalance deepens, you will just fall asleep. So, you know, I was once at our intensive retreats at IMS. There's something happens before breakfast. I don't even know what. I'm never there. And then there's breakfast, and then there's work or walk period. And then there's a sitting, usually around 8:15, 8:30 in the morning, where the teacher will be giving instruction and where you know, people are sitting, and we sit, and then there's question and answer in that particular sitting. So it was my turn one morning. So I went in, and I sat down, and I was sitting up there, and I just closed my eyes and put my attention on the breath. And right away, I went into that ooze, you know. I should say, well, it's a phase everyone goes through at different times. And also sometimes people have strong just tendencies toward one or the other, either the calm and sleepy side of things or the energized and restless side of things. So it's definitely my thing. So I just sat down and went into the use right away. And maybe, you know, 15 or 20 minutes later, I had the thought, oh, maybe I should actually be noting in, out, along with feeling the breath. And I did that, and just doing that was enough energy interjected into my systems that it's like the clouds cleared. And I realized I had been sitting in front of about 100 people for like 15 minutes, and they'd all been waiting for some instruction. And I had just been kind of like oozing along. And, you know, so I didn't say anything, and then I rang the bell and at the end of the sitting, and I described what had just happened, and I gave a big plug for mental noting. You know, so we're always kind of adjusting in some way, not obsessively, you know, because then you're just like, am I, you know, too hyped up? Am I, you know, it's really not that. You're not even assessing. But sometimes the intuition arises, like, oh, look at this. I'm sort of like... and it's also the case that different methods have inherently kind of a different balance. Walking, obviously, will have more energy than sitting. Loving kindness tends to have more energy than being with the breath because we are silently repeating certain phrases, like, may I be happy, may you be happy. And that's verbal, it means something. And what tends to happen, or what I found anyway, is that if I was with the breath as a method, I might be in that ooze for some period before I realized it. Whereas with loving kindness, what happens in that state is the phrases tend to get garbled. And so you have a pretty quick feedback system that your balance is off. So, for example, in Burma, sometimes I would be sitting there and I'd hear myself repeating, may you be filled with suffering, may you be filled. I'd go, no, may you be free of suffering, you know, like, or my favorite example of that still, until someone comes, that's an invitation for someone to come up with a better one. I have a friend who's Swiss, and so English is literally his fourth language. And he was sitting at IMS one year doing loving kindness, and his phrases were something like, you know, beginning with oneself, may I be healthy and well, may I live with ease. And one day he heard himself repeating, may I be wealthy in hell, and may I live with eels. And he, you know, he just kept repeating it because English is his fourth language. And then he stopped and he said, that sounds funny. So he like flipped back to Swiss German and was like, oh, that is funny, you know. But it's good because it's pretty quick that it's a feedback system. And it's just, you know, again, it's not bad. It's not like you're done wrong, but it's a clue, you know, like maybe pick up your energy some. Hello. And the opposite could be true, of course. We could have a lot of energy and enthusiasm and interest, but not quite enough calm or concentration in our system to match. And then you find yourself maybe planning and planning and planning and planning. And you're getting more hyped up, or you're getting restless, you're getting anxious. It's like this big energy is not being met by enough quiet. That's all. It's also just an imbalance. And so there are a couple of things that are done to try to bring our system into balance. One is simplicity, you know, and very much a sense of almost a kind of sensual connection, you know, like feeling your breath as though your hands were in water, you know, and you're feeling those sensations. It's very much an emphasis on kind of the soothing nature of those sensations. Don't try to be very elaborate in the practice at that time. The simplicity, repetition, structure will help create more calm and concentration. This is very interesting and useful in loving kindness practice as well, because When we do loving kindness practice and we're offering loving kindness or compassion to someone, these are real relationships. These are real beings, you know, people, animals. We're not asked to, like, imagine a composite picture of a person living on the street in Seattle. You know, like, if you're offering loving kindness to a homeless person in Seattle, it's because you know them or you've seen them or you've heard about them. They exist, right? And so because they're real relationships, that means complexity. Relationships are just complex. So, as you know, I started saying yesterday in the classical arc of the practice, not for any one session, but over time, we offer loving kindness to a benefactor, that's someone who's helped us or maybe inspired us from afar. We offer loving kindness to a friend. We offer loving kindness to a neutral person, someone we don't particularly like or dislike. They're just kind of there, you know? We offer loving kindness to a difficult person, and not like a horrific person right away, but starting with a mildly difficult person, we work our way. And then all beings everywhere. So it's not uncommon for somebody to come up and say, you know, I was offering loving kindness to my benefactor, and I was filled with gratitude and everything was going well. And then I had the thought, you know, there was that one time when I called you and you weren't really there for me. Maybe you're not my benefactor. Maybe you're my difficult person. You know, life is kind of molten that way. As the Dalai Lama said, quoting Shantideva, this great Tibetan sage, friends become enemies. Enemies become friends. You know, life is complicated. And just the sheer tendency in loving kindness to tell stories, you know, this is a real being, we start to tell a story about them, means that energy will be higher than concentration. And we have to keep that in mind. So to work with simplicity, repetition, structure, to deepen concentration, and not just spend like 15 hours imagining this person happy on this vacation, and then the next vacation, and the next vacation, you know, because that's just thinking, just like the others just napping. It's not that thoughts are bad or wrong, but the sort of endless fantasies we do anyway, you know, you don't have to call that a practice. So I often think about, I went to Burma, as I said yesterday, in 1985, to do this intensive period of loving kindness practice, and there was one point where Upandita, my teacher, said, I want you to go back to your room and offer loving kindness to a good friend. So I went back to my room, and I thought of a friend immediately. And then I was just off, you know, like, what's the time difference between Rangoon and Northampton, Mass? I think it's dinner time there. I wonder if she went out to dinner. I bet she went out to dinner. Where might she have gone to dinner? So then began the restaurant tour of Northampton. Would she go to the Japanese restaurant, or would she go to the Italian restaurant? She couldn't have gone to that other restaurant because I think that one closed. I wonder why it closes. And this is a completely true story. It's not one of the things I'm making up. I wonder why it closed. Restaurants in that corner always close. It's so strange. It's got really good parking. It's really close to Smith College. There's no reason for those restaurants to always close, but they always close. I wonder if that spot has really bad feng shui. What is feng shui anyway? You know, that's very far from may you be happy, may you be peaceful, right? Which is where the power comes from. It's from the complete wholehearted presence of our attention behind one phrase at a time. You know, and so given that that I know is the tendency of my mind, in my own practice and therefore in my teaching, I tend to emphasize the simplicity, the technique, come back. Keep it simple. You know, once somebody came to me and said, I can't remember all my phrases. So I said, well, how many phrases do you have? And they said, like 15. And I said, no one can remember 15 phrases, you know, 3 or 4 phrases. As much as possible, use the same phrases. For, you know, it's not always possible, for sure. Like, somebody comes to mind and for whatever reason, either they are accompanied by their own phrases, or it would be too much of a struggle to use the other ones. But you don't want to be constantly trying to think of new phrases for every being that you're moving your attention to, because, again, it's just too much discursivity. And you'll have a lot of energy, but you won't have much concentration. So that's why the phrases are so general. Whatever phrases you end up settling on, they need to be pretty general so that it's going to be as much as possible applicable to many people. And within that, given that, we also play. You know, you don't want the phrases to be deadened or rote or meaningless. So sometimes we fix that mechanically, almost technically, by gathering our attention and really being fully there, even if it's just one phrase. It's the same way sometimes people with the breath will be helped by saying, just this one breath. And then do it again, just this. You know, so it's really gathering your attention and aiming will help. Sometimes we really do play, you know. You try to get a stronger sense of the recipient, whether that's through visualization or just a sense that they're right here. Sometimes you let active imagination take over. Like, what would it be like for this person to be happy? You know, and you let your mind go wild for a little bit, you know, and then you begin the practice sort of in that way. My Swiss friend, same Swiss friend, was in Barry another time, and he was doing sympathetic joy meditation, which is joy in the happiness of others. And I, nicely enough, was one of his recipients. You know, so he came to me and he said, "What would make you really happy?" He said, "Would flying in a private plane make you really happy?" And I said, "That'd make me really happy." So that's how he imagined me, was flying around on a private plane. So it was nice. you know, so we also play. It's not meant to be like so strained or labored, you know, that we don't have fun doing that. But always there's a balance, you know, and it's up to you to sense, like, oh, you know, I just sat here and refurnished her jet, you know, for the 15th time. It's probably a little much, you know, like something like that, you know. So balance is really inherent. And that kind of immediate, direct working with balance of energy and calm is really, almost, it's like almost technically that's the whole show. Because everything else emerges from that. It's like we're setting the stage. We're creating the conditions for wisdom to arise, to insight to arise, for love to arise, for the sense of connection to arise. Rather than those being sort of reified states that we're grasping after and, you know, thinking, well, you know, if I get a big insight before lunch, I don't have to come back in the afternoon, you know, like, it's not like that. We're just continually setting the stage and observing as these qualities that change our lives so much as they emerge, which they will, all by themselves. You know, it's like we're growing the garden and nature will take care of the rest. So that's sort of the flavor or the tone, the spirit of the practice. So that's balance in those kind of very immediate ways. We also look at balance in terms of action. And sometimes, you know, somebody asked me yesterday about compassionate action and what about like when you don't know what to do? And I think that's a considerable amount of the time. Sometimes we're served just by a pause or a moment of sheer connection. Again, to see what emerges from that. It's like, it's not that you never want to try to make a difference. It's almost the definition of compassion. You know, to move toward to see if you can be of help. But in some powerful way that seems to be best done from a place of simple connection, really kind of a pure connection. So, for example, the kind of classic story for me that I tell is about 1979, when the Dalai Lama came to visit the Insight Meditation Society. It was, I think, his first trip to North America, and Bob Thurman, who was a professor at the time at Amherst College, which is about 40 minutes away from Barry, invited him. They were, you know, old friends from India and so on. And so we heard that the Dalai Lama was coming to Amherst. And being young and naive, we shot off a letter to the private office, and we said, oh, we're a Buddhist center too. Maybe you'd like to come visit us. And to our astonishment, we got a letter in response saying, yeah, he'll come. So I don't know how many of you have gone to see him here, and I have seen him here in Seattle, you know. So this was a long time ago, and security was nothing like it is right now, but still it was very intense for us. The center is about 2 miles outside of the town of Barrie on this little country road called Pleasant Street. So we had to blockade Pleasant Street, and we had state troopers patrolling the roof with guns, you know, and things like that. And so imagine if they were like here, you know. It was very intense for us. So the day came that he was going to arrive, and just a little while before, I'd been in a car accident, and I had a broken bone in my foot, and I was using crutches, which I was extremely klutzy with. So the day came that he was going to come, and I was standing in the back of about 100 people waiting outside for him to arrive. And I was way in the back and feeling very sorry for myself. So my inner dialogue was something like, oh, you know, this is such a pity. You know, here I am stuck way in the back, and I helped start the place, for God's sake. I should be in the front, but I'm such an incredible klutz. If I were in the front, I'd probably fall on my face in front of them, that'd be even worse. I better stay in the back. Oh, but I'm in the back. You know, so it went on like that. And his car pulled up, and he got out, and he did something I've seen him do many times since, but it was the first time I'd ever seen him do it, which is that he got out of the car, and he seemed to have some kind of radar for who in the crowd was suffering the most. So in this case, it was me. And he just got out of the car, he cut through 100 people, and he took my hands and he looked me in the eye and he said, what happened? And that became a part of my deepest understanding of compassion as well, because I realized in that moment he could not make my injury not have happened. He couldn't make me any more skilled in my use of the crutches, but that horrible feeling of being so unseen, so unknown, so stuck in the back, was gone. So what if we started there, you know? This is where, you know, it's extremely subtle and it's hard to understand. It can be mistaken in a lot of ways, but this is where we hear teachings like, I once went to a teacher, a Tibetan teacher of mine, because I had a friend who was like phenomenally depressed, and it seemed like there was like no end to it, although it actually has had a happy ending. He's fine, you know, but it really didn't look like it was going to go that way for a very, very long time. And I went to this teacher, and I was very frustrated at my inability to help him, my friend. So I said to the teacher, what can I do to help him? And the teacher said, stop trying. Right? Which didn't mean stop visiting, stop showing up. It meant just be there. You know, be there in a moment together. And that's why I said it's a very subtle teaching, because it can imply resignation. And it's not meant to. But let's see what emerges out of just that sense of connecting. And not trying, not having a strategy, not having a plan. And it was interesting visiting. He was in a psych hospital, and I'd visit him, and I'd see other people visiting him. And you know, these are not really easy places to be. It's kind of an enormous thing to visit somebody. It was great that they were there. But I'd also watch, you know, like the regimens that were being offered. Like, you know, if you take 5 drops of this rose tincture, you'll be out of here in a week. And I think, well, maybe, you know, maybe not. And as beautiful as that was as a gesture, I could also feel that the internal experience of my friend was one of being pressured. Like, what if it doesn't work? What if I fail you? Will you still come? Will you still care about me? Where's the love actually there? Where's the generosity? What if it doesn't work? Is that okay? And so I'm not saying never offer rose tincture. Maybe it is the answer. But what about if we start just with that sense of beingness? Here we are together. And let's see what feels right in that moment. I think even if you offer, you know, 15 times the volume of rose tincture, it wouldn't have that same hook. It would feel different. I can also remember when Ramdas had sort of that massive stroke. And at the time, he was living in California. Now he lives on Maui. But he was living in California, and I went to see him soon after he got out of the hospital. And his living room was piled with things that people were sending. And it was beautiful. You know, I don't want to in any way disparage that. It's absolutely beautiful. And sometimes the message would just have that other feeling. Like, take 15 drops of this and you'll definitely be walking in 2 weeks. And the day I was visiting him, he got a big bottle of Ganges water, water from the Ganges River, that said exactly that. And I said to him, don't take that. You'll get cholera if you take that. Like, don't drink that. Whatever you do, you know, and so that is good-heartedness, but is it really wise action to have that pressure as part of our offering? You know, which is why we use mindfulness to look back at our intention, our motive, and we come from the best motive we can, and we try to learn skill in our action and our speech and so on. I was here actually seeing the Dalai Lama when somewhere in his lecture he said, you know, perhaps it's not so skillful to say it's warm in the room because maybe not everyone is feeling warm. Surely it's better to say I am feeling warm. And I was practically rolling on the floor laughing, you know, thinking, who's he been talking to? He sounds like every communications coach from California I've ever heard, you know. Then I realized he'd probably been talking to communications coaches from California. Talks to all kinds of people. And as formulaic and laborious and sort of unpleasant as that can be, use eye language. I think it actually works. I think it's actually a skillful thing. So the example I use is, you know, I tend to use is, say you go to the movies with a friend and you walk out and the friend says, that was the best movie ever made. There is now not enough room in the universe for you to say I didn't like it that much. They have laid down absolute truth forevermore. That was the best movie ever made. Whereas if you walk out of the theater and they say, I love that movie, you could say, I didn't like it that much. And that's where genuine communication and dialogue can happen. Right? So as formulaic as it can seem, I think it's actually skillful. We learn skills of action, of communication, of caring, of kindness. You know, you learn. You have a friend who's really despairing and you don't say, you know, hop to, get over it. Doesn't actually tend to work. But it's not to say we know the perfect answer either. We can only come from the best place in terms of motivation that we can and be aware as we can be of context of where we are sensitive, our own fears, whatever it might be, and learn, you know, some basic skills. Like the example I used yesterday, if you're supervising someone at work, it doesn't tend to be that skillful to say you're an idiot. You know, that doesn't mean you can't be fierce and you can't be intense and strong, but you sort of learn, oh, well, that didn't help, you know. the billionth time I tried it. Being accusatory doesn't seem to be that skillful. Things like that. So we kind of grow and change and learn, even as we continue probably to make mistakes and need to learn from those as well. So I want to go back for a moment to that model I used yesterday where I talked about different aspects of action, the motivation or the intention behind the action, which is a field of tremendous growth and learning for us. Learning skills of behavior, learning to be more sensitive to context, being willing to try. You know, maybe it's time to try a strong boundary, which we've never tried before, or something like that. And then there's the immediate result. You know, you give someone a gift and they thank you and they say, I've been so looking forward to getting this book. I couldn't be more grateful. Or they say, yeah, thanks. And they walk away. That's the aspect that we have no control over. As wise as we get, as mindful as we get, as full of compassion as we get, you can't control how someone else is going to react. So I don't want to imply that that doesn't register with us and it's not impactful. I mean, it might be important, but to have the idea ever that we will, that we can define success, for example, by everybody jumping up and down with joy and getting that book, it's not so likely, right? Because we can't control it. Somebody could be having a delightful, amazing, wondrous day, and the book is so minor in their consideration of the day that they're not going to jump up and down. Or they're having a tough time, and you're just like a distraction in giving them the book from what they really need to be thinking about. Kind of annoying in that, at that, you know. And, or they're in so much psychological pain that they hardly even register that you gave them the book. You know, we can't control that. And that's a place for equanimity, which means balance. Not indifference and not callousness, but recognizing through wisdom, we're not in control of the unfolding of the universe. We need to assess our action, and that is largely through knowing our motive and the skillfulness of our action. Maybe it wasn't that skillful to hurl the book across the room at them, you know. Maybe I should have walked up to them and given it to them. Try that next time. And understanding, even though it is impacting us, it's just the way it is. As the Buddha said, there's pleasure and pain and gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. It's just the way it is. And, you know, maybe just as a reflection for a few moments, see if something comes to your mind from your own experience, your own life, where you did something, you did an innovation, you changed something, you offered something, and some people were so happy, and some people were so unhappy at the very same action. And just see if something pops up in your mind, or maybe it will later, you know, in some way. Those tend to be my favorite examples because it's the very same action that is eliciting very, very different responses from different people. So again, as I said yesterday, it's not that we don't care, but the question is, how much do we care? And are we completely defined by something we can't actually control? Or are we inspired maybe to make some change or, you know, try to be more aware of something, but not devastated by a reaction we couldn't insist not be there in any reasonable fashion? When I when my last book came out, my most recent book, better not be my last book, my most recent book came out, it was really funny. At some point, it's called Real Love, and at some point, Amazon, which is in Seattle, right? Somehow blended the reviews, which were, I don't know, 18 or something like that, with the reviews of another book, which were like 350 or something. So all of a sudden, somebody said to me, boy, you've got a lot of reviews on Amazon. So I looked, and it was like hundreds of reviews. And I thought, what is this? And then I looked at some of the reviews, which said things like, this guy is just teaching people how to catch babes. And I went, what? Yeah. And I realized that somehow, I don't know how, this guy's book about dating and my book on real love had become one under my book's name. And I complained and complained and complained and complained. I was just like, I finally said, forget it. You know, it's like the publisher complained and complained and complained. So now I'm thinking, oh, I'm in Amazon's town, I should think. And just a couple of weeks ago, they separated them again. Now we're apart. So I'm back to like 18 reviews. You know? Like, but you think, you know, people set their hearts on these things. Like, not with book number 10, because you learn, you know, but you just cannot control, like, every element of the universe. And if that's going to define your very worth as a human, as a writer, as a person trying to make a difference, you're in trouble. Because there's no lack of things that go wrong, right? And so we care, and yet, if you spend all day thinking about that, it's not a good day. You know, it really isn't. Now I think I should have flown to Seattle. Like, banged on the door. You know, is there a door at Amazon? I don't know. Like, does it exist? Just a physical entity? It's like, weird. You know, equanimity does not mean passivity. It doesn't mean you don't try to, you know, change something or make a difference. It doesn't mean you just sit there and take it. But can you have kind of a perspective about life so that the things you try are in context, you know, to what really makes us happy and what's important and what's possible and the truth of change, of constant change, and interdependence. You know, it's not just a single person ever, you know, it's, we're all part of a network. So I started out the weekend with that reflection about how many people have been involved and you're sitting in this room right now. Because we're all here as part of a network, right? Of influence, of connection, of contact. That's the truth of our existence. So that it's wisdom that brings us equanimity. So it's perspective. And wisdom, of course, doesn't just come from meditation. It comes from growing older, hopefully. You know, you've just seen, you know, so much, or you've had to let go of so much, and you understand, like, I am really not going to sweat the small stuff. You know, Amazon, do whatever you want. It's like, all right. You know, so through life experience, we develop that kind of perspective or understanding. And the thing about meditation is that it's very kind of streamlined. It's direct. Let's take a look at how things actually are. Let's not get distracted. Let's look deeper. So it's a tremendous tool for developing insight and wisdom, which will reinforce a sense of balance and perspective and wisdom. And then that itself allows us to look more deeply because we're not freaking out over everything we see. I can almost trace the trajectory of my progress in meditation, not from so much from what arises, but how I have been with what arises. And I think I said the other day to somebody, or maybe it was to the group, you know how you can have the feeling of learning the same thing again and again and again and again, but hopefully at a deeper level all the time. And one of the things for many people, they would say they learned, I'll tell you in the context of the story. I have a friend, Mark Epstein, who's a psychiatrist in New York City and has written several books on Buddhism and psychotherapy. Like Thoughts Without a Thinker was his first book, and almost like kind of defined the field. And so we first met Mark in 1974 when he was an undergraduate, and we began teaching at Naropa Institute. It was the first summer that we were back from India, and it was the first summer that Naropa was opened in Boulder. And so Mark was there as a student, and a few years ago, you know, then he went to medical school and he became a psychiatrist and does some teaching. And he and I were teaching together somewhere, and he told the story. He said from 1974, when he first began meditating, he'd been keeping a notebook. He had a resolve to try to go on retreat every year of some length or another. It didn't always work because of family and medical school and all that, but it often worked. So he'd been on usually at least one retreat a year over the course of all these years. And he said he kept a notebook, the same notebook, every retreat. And in the notebook, he would write down either his most important insight and, or usually and, if there was something the teacher, he mostly sat with Joseph, if there was something the teacher said that was kind of like, oh, mind-opening or heart-opening, it was like one of those moments of like, oh, wow, he'd write that down as well. So just a couple of years ago, so this is almost every year since 1974, same notebook. So just a couple of years ago, he decided to read over his notes from 1974, and he said, to his complete shock, every year he'd basically written down the same thing. It was some variation on what arises in your experience is not so important. What's really important is how you are with what arises in your experience. It was like year after year after year after year. And I really related to that because as I look back over my years and studying with different teachers, I think, oh, well, that teacher said that to me. And like 4 years later, that teacher said that to me. And it's kind of the same thing, you know. So it's not easy to have balance and presence and perspective with whatever arises in our experience. It's possible, and that's what we're working toward. And certainly we have a range, all of us, where it's easier. And then there's a range where it gets tougher. We don't like what's going on. We think it shouldn't be there. We think we should be beyond it. Whatever it might be. And so I can remember my very first teacher, who was S.N. Goenka, and doing a number of retreats with him, and then being somewhat famous for once having marched up to him and looking at him and saying, I never used to be an angry person before I started to meditate, thereby laying blame exactly where I felt it belonged, which was on him. Clearly it was his fault. But really, of course, I'd been hugely angry and I hadn't known it because I'd never really looked inside. And so I looked inside and there it was. So more like, you know, 6 years later, I told the story the other day about sitting with Manindra at IMS and how he said to me, why are you so upset about that thought which has arisen in your mind? Did you invite it? Did you say I'd like to be filled with self-loathing at 6 p.m.? No. But when things arise, the conditions come together for something to arise, it'll arise. So how are we going to deal with it is the point. And so right in that same retreat, I had some period of anger and I didn't like it. I didn't want it to be there. And at that point, I probably thought it was 6 years. It should be gone. And he could tell, I'm sure from my tone of voice, in which I was describing my experience, that I didn't like it much. And he said to me, this is how you should be with your anger. Imagine a spaceship has landed on the front lawn and these Martians come out and they come up to you and they say, what is anger? What is anger? That's how you should be with your anger. Not it's right, it's wrong, I'm going to do this about it. I have the wrong therapist, you know. But like, what is this? What do I feel in my body? What's kind of the anger movie? It's in watching the anger movie, not judging and not adding or embellishing that you see. Look how much sadness there is in there. Look at how much disappointment. Look at how much helplessness, whatever it is. And that way, if and when we decide to take action, we can take action based on a much more comprehensive sense of all the different feelings, you know, not just the topmost layer. And also it's a, especially if you feel that kind of helplessness at the core of anger, it's a call for action. You know, doing a small thing, it may seem very small, is actually better for us and for the world, you know, whether it's a family situation or a more global situation, even if it seems very small, that's better than fuming. You know, and I say that also as a sort of public person, you know, who the times if I, you know, go on Twitter, which is all day long, but, you know, that I put an opinion on Twitter, it's really interesting to see what comes back, you know, like, you know, where people feel they can say anything. It's kind of amazing, you know. And to realize that it's one thing to fume at others on Twitter, and it's another thing to take some action according to what you feel is right in this world or important in your family, even if it's small, small thing, is very different. And if we don't do that and we just let the helplessness build and the feeling of not being able to do anything, it's almost like nihilism build, we'll increasingly just lash out. I was talking to somebody yesterday about times, for example. I'm a big believer in voting. If this were closer to an election, I would be going on and on about it. I think it's very important to vote. It's very close to what I see as the Buddha's message about the innate dignity of everybody. Everybody should have a voice. And we need to exercise that or don't complain about anything, you know. So I've often written, you know, about voting. I never tell anyone who I think they should vote for, but I think the sheer act of voting is very important. And it's very common, always, actually, I would say, somebody in the comments section writes and says, I think so much less of you now. Because you're, yeah, very funny. it always starts that way, too. I think so much less of you now. Because you're asking people to participate in an evil system or a violent system. And I think, you know, if you didn't just sit in front of that keyboard all day and write people things like that, and you drove one person to the polls, you know, like, you'd have more of an effect than, you know, just the vitriol. But we certainly live in a time of vitriol. That's another cause for equanimity, you know. It's like, okay, I'll think about that. But it's all right, you know, I've thought about it a lot already, you know. You know, so what do we see if we can sit with the anger? Instead of, you know, declaring it as right and or wrong, but to really understand layers and layers and layers of feeling and responses and what are the roots of that? Why do we feel so helpless? And can we address that? You know, maybe it's not going to be in action that will be dramatic. Maybe it will be in listening to somebody or thanking them or giving them room to express themselves or maybe it will be more active action than that. We'll see, you know, what seems right to us, but something. You know, and that's not easy, but it's very, very powerful to have enough balance to sit with all these different states. And it's the same with the joy, you know, and the delight and the wonderful states. It's not easy for everybody to sit with those either and not just kind of dismiss them or, you know, challenge them in some way. So I also feel like I got that same lesson. I'd get that same lesson a billion times. Just start with being with your experience, right? Simply connect to what's actually happening. Let's see what emerges from the understanding or what will unfold from that. So that's the place of the equanimity. Okay, let me hang in here with this. Not because I will never do anything about it or it's smart to just sit here forever. But let's see what environment gets created and what insight can emerge from that and then what action might come from that place of insight. Okay, so we're going to do some walking meditation. So again, this is a period I'll ask you to be silent. And really, you have a choice. If you want to do mindful walking, well, in some ways, whatever you want to do, eyes open. And if you can get outside, I hear it's going to be hotter later. So this is a good time to get out. And or in here, you know, just find a space where you can walk back and forth. We want to have a very light awareness resting on something so that we can also be aware of everything going on around us so we're not barging into one another. The light awareness and mindfulness is on the sensations of movement, your feet touching the ground, or your leg coming up and going down, or your body moving through space. You can move at any pace. Don't look too weird if you're outside. You can look as weird as you want in here in the sense of moving slowly, but not slow enough to lose your balance. And remember, ultimately, we want to be able to do walking meditation down the streets of a big city. So at least some of it, you have to be walking at a normal pace. If you want to do loving kindness practice, the way I suggested yesterday was that that light attention is not resting on the feeling of your body movement. It's on the silent repetition of certain phrases. And the way I suggested doing it yesterday, which I'd suggest again, is that the baseline is offering loving kindness to yourself. And here I only use two phrases myself so I can match it to my steps. So I'm silently repeating, may I be happy, be peaceful, be happy, be peaceful, like that. And then when someone comes strongly into my consciousness, like I see someone walk by or I hear a bird or I hear a dog, for a moment I just include them like, oh, be happy. And then I go back, right? So it's not like a deep absorption into the phrases because that would be like too much. I was actually walking down the streets of New York not too long ago, and someone was texting, and he barged into me. And I thought, well, this is like a cartoon, you know, but it's real. You know, so you don't want to do that another way, which is just by being super absorbed into the phrases. You want to be aware of everything going on around you, but you've got these phrases going. And it really is my favorite way of walking down the streets of New York. Like, sometimes I'm doing loving kindness, and someone coming from the other direction, like, smiles at me. And I think, oh, maybe they're doing it too. It's like we've got the secret love club going on in New York, you know. It's fun. Okay, so it's really up to you which you'd like to do, or some of each. And we'll come back here in about half an hour. As I said yesterday, if you're going to do loving kindness practice, it's usually three or four phrases while sitting. The phrases need to be pretty general. If you're used to doing loving kindness, please just continue with whatever phrases you've been using. if you're not used to doing it and you want to do it, the most sort of generic phrases that I know of, which you're welcome to experiment with, and I'd urge you to experiment with, at least at first, otherwise you'll spend the entire day trying to think of phrases, are beginning with oneself, may I be safe? Or some people prefer saying, repeating, may I feel safe? May I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. Live with ease means in the things of day-to-day life, like livelihood or family, may not be such a struggle. May I live with ease. The feeling tone is a blessing. It's offering. It's gift-giving. It's like handing someone a birthday card and saying, may you have a great year. May you have a happy birthday. It's not pleading or begging or asking. We're not actually asking anything of anybody. We're offering. May you be safe. May I be safe. The words won't be perfect, being words, but we utilize them. The phrases are a way of paying attention differently. So rather than, for example, calling someone to mind and just thinking of their faults, we're wishing them well. We're offering this. Or rather than ignoring someone or looking right through them, in the case of what's known as the neutral person, for example, you know, we're wishing them well. We're making this offering to them. So the classical arc of the practice is like way too much for any one sitting, mostly without feeling kind of jumbled. So what we usually say is, see if you can begin with yourself, end with all beings, everywhere, this kind of global expanse of offering loving kindness. And what you do in the middle might be different all the time. So you have a friend who's getting an award today. You want to be sure to include them. Or somebody's graduating from high school today. You want to be sure to include them. Or you have a friend who's in trouble and they've asked for some loving kindness. You want to be sure to include them. The neutral person is often somebody we encounter now and then, someone who plays some role in our life that we don't have a particular feeling for or against. So it's, you know, checkout person in the supermarket, or the story often tells about someone used their dry cleaner as the recipient. And so it's a chance to see in real life, not in the sitting, but in real life, if that sense of relationship grows as you encounter this person now and then. So maybe you're going to the dry cleaner today, and so you want to be sure to include them in your sitting of 15 or 20 minutes or however long it is. So I'm going to guide you through just one of a billion variations of starting with yourself and ending with all beings. Okay, and if you choose not to do loving kindness in this sitting, it's fine. Just ignore me or hear my voice as sound. Okay? So again, see if you can sit comfortably. Bring your energy into your body. See if there are three or four phrases that seem workable to you. Phrases like, may I be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. So the feeling tone is blessing, it's offering, it's gift giving. And we ourselves are the first recipient. Don't worry about what you're feeling and you're not feeling. The power of the practice comes from the complete wholehearted gathering of our attention behind one phrase at a time. And if you find your attention slipping off, you go to the past or the future or whatever, don't worry about it. It's the same thing. See if you can let go gently. And in this case, bring your attention back to the phrases. And see if you can call to mind a benefactor. That's someone who's helped you. Maybe they're helping you right now, or maybe they've inspired you from afar. Someone who lifts your spirits when you think of them. Could be an adult, could be a child, could be a pet. Who makes you smile? when you think of them. So if there's someone, you can bring them here. Get an image of them or say their name to yourself. Get a feeling for their presence and offer the phrases of loving kindness to them. And if there's no one, that's fine too. You can just continue on offering loving kindness to yourself. And even if the words are not perfect, they're carrying the energy of the heart. So we use them, they're serving us. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease, or whatever your phrases have been. And just for fun, for a few minutes, imagine what it's like for the benefactor to offer loving kindness to you. So you can sort of position yourself in the place of the recipient. And here's this being wishing you well. You may feel all kinds of different things, resistance, embarrassment, joy, delight, whatever it is, see if that can just wash through you as you steady your attention on the phrases, which probably become, may you be happy, be peaceful, and so on. See if you can call a friend to mind who's doing pretty well right now. They may not be perfectly happy, but at least in some arena of life, they're enjoying success or good fortune. So if someone like that comes to mind, bring them here and offer the phrases of loving kindness to them. And a friend who's not doing so well right now, bring them here. See what happens as you offer the phrases of loving kindness. And then everybody here, including yourself, may we be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. And all beings everywhere, all people, all creatures, all those in existence, near and far, known and unknown, may all beings be safe, be happy, be healthy. So thank you. Do you have any questions or comments about anything you experienced in the walking or the sitting about love, about equanimity?
Yes.
So, you probably were taught that. It's just not the way I teach. I don't think it was Sylvia either, because she was my student. I should say, there are lots of ways of doing this practice. Yes, I will in a second. There are lots of ways of doing this practice. There are lots of approaches. It's not right and wrong. Usually people teach, and most strikingly in terms of what was really helpful for them. And there are so many approaches. There are people in Burma, for example, who did loving kindness practice very, very visually. It was really about holding an image of the recipient. And so people would walk around with photos of themselves. And you'd have like a little altar in front of you, which you were on, and then you'd look at it and you'd fix the image. And then when you'd lose it, you'd open your eyes again. So there are like a million approaches. So the question was about doing loving kindness, believing she was taught this by somebody, where you do loving kindness for yourself until you feel your heart opening and you feel a sense of softness and safety. And then you go on to extend loving kindness to others. And if in that process you stop feeling safe or you start feeling uneasy, you go back to offering loving kindness to yourself. So, if that's the way you are used to practicing and that's the way you like to practice, that seems fine. It's not the way I teach. So
it's not about, it's not so much about, it's not about the feelings.
Yeah. So, and I teach, you know, without emphasizing feeling a certain way, because that was my experience, that the practice, it turns out, was having a very strong effect, even if I did not feel a certain thing. And it was only over the course of time, perhaps, that I would notice, oh, I'm different. In real life, I'm different. The way I speak to myself or the way I meet a stranger. And it was not because I was sitting there flooded with, you know, a feeling of joy or safety or anything. Probably my signature story about loving kindness, which is in my first book, Loving Kindness, was I started meditation practice, which was really mindfulness practice, in 1971. And Goenka, as those of you who've sat with him or in his style know, would end the 10-day retreat with just a little bit of loving kindness practice. And it was almost a ceremonial way of saying goodbye, you know, but the first time I heard it, I thought, ooh, what's that? You know, I want to learn more about that. And there wasn't really the opportunity in that system. So, but I read and I studied. And so I knew basically how it was done, you know, when you start with yourself and you go through these categories and the phrases and all that. So there are ways of teaching it without phrases at all, but that's what I'd studied. So then in 1976, on Valentine's Day, we moved into the building that's the Insight Meditation Society, and there was no programming for another month. So those of us who were there in the beginning said, well, why don't we just do a retreat ourselves? So I thought, okay, I've got a month, and I know how to do loving kindness. I don't have anyone to guide me, but I'll just do it. I know how to do it. So I spent the first week just doing loving kindness for myself, you know, using phrases like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, whatever they were. And I felt absolutely nothing. It was like a completely dreary week. And then something happened to someone like in our larger community in Boston at the end of the week. So several of us had to suddenly leave the retreat. So I was up in one of the bathrooms getting ready to go when I dropped this big jar of something, and it just like went down on the tile floor and it shattered and the stuff went everywhere. And I can remember the first thought that came up in my mind was, you are really a klutz, but I love you. And I thought, look at that. You know, you could have given me anything in the course of the week, and I could not have honestly said something was happening, but something was happening. And I have seen that literally thousands of times with others, you know, myself and others. So I really, from my point of view, getting kind of fixated on what you're feeling could be counterproductive. Because it also feeds into the self-judgment thing. Yesterday I felt more love, that was pure love. Today it's all tainted with conditions, and you know, like it's not as good today, and it was longer yesterday. Anyway, it was 5 minutes, today was only three, you know, like. So for me, I would rather, to the extent possible, not be focusing on that. But that's not to say that it obviously was helpful for this other person, you know, which is why they teach that way. And it's perfectly viable. It's not like wrong. I think I would have had myself some problems with it. And so that's just not how I. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yes.
So, play and remain with our focus?
What kind of emotion?
Sometimes, well, often tearful emotions, either from love or grief.
Okay, so. The question was about the phrases provoking a certain emotion. So do we treat those the way we treat thoughts in being with the breath? It depends also, you know. So even in this system, which emphasizes phrases, they say in any moment of metta, one of three things may be predominant. One is the phrase. One is the sense of the recipient. Either a visual sense, or it's like they're right here, you know. And the third is a feeling that is coming up. Not so much the grief, but the kind of warmth, you know, the love that's coming up. So There's nothing wrong with dropping the phrase for a while and just being with the sense of the recipient or with the feeling. But the feeling will come and go. Not everyone has a great facility with visualization, and the sense of the recipient may come and go. We might actually bring it back if we're getting dreamy and vague, but so the bottom line is kind of the phrases. You know, the feeling of grief is something else, you know, like tremendous grief may arise, anger, anguish, all kinds of things. Even as you're, you know, pondering happiness, you know, it seems a little weird, but it's right, you know. And there it depends, you know, on the intensity of what's arising, how we treat it. The first avenue is actually see if you can let go and come back to the phrases. Not in a dismissive way or a disparaging way, but it's sort of like loving kindness is considered a concentration practice. And that means that we spend some amount of time in effect saying, not right now. This is not wrong or this is not bad, but like not right now. It's like if you had a car mechanic working on your car, you would really want them to be concentrating on what they're doing, right? And some issue with their mortgage might come up in their minds. And what you'd really prefer, they think, is not right now, you know? Not because they should never think about it or it's not important, but you really want them to be paying attention to what they're doing because, I mean, your life really depends on that, you know? And so it's kind of like that. But sometimes that doesn't work because the intensity of what's coming up is too strong. So then maybe it's a feeling that is very painful for us. So that might be a signal to go back and offer ourselves loving kindness, sort of in the midst of this feeling. And maybe that won't work either because it's just too strong. So then we sort of drop the loving kindness and in effect try to be mindful of the feeling in as warm and kind a way as possible, until it begins to recede somewhat, and then we just go back when we feel like it, and or inspired to, we pick up the loving kindness again. So it's sort of a different phases that we try, and whenever that is suggested, it's important not to fall into, oh, the first thing I tried didn't work, that means I'm like a bad yogi, you know? I had to go all the way to number three, you know? Like, it's not like that. It's the same, there's some really funny list that I enjoy a lot, supposedly from the Buddha himself, about how to deal with sleepiness in meditation. And the first several things on the list are very mechanical, like open your eyes, stand up. You know, maybe do a walking instead of a sitting. Some are about how we pay attention. You know, if you say in effect, just this one breath or just this one phrase, it's like your energy will pick up. If you're kind of with this breath and getting ready for the next 50, you'll fall asleep. You know, so it's like really gathering your attention and aiming your attention picks up your energy. There's something on the list which I never do, but probably works, which is pull your earlobes.
Is that how he got those long earlobes?
That's how he got the long earlobes. It's a joke, yeah. No, I think he got them because he was a prince. He had all his earrings. But yeah, I don't know why people, acupuncturists always nod their heads and say, oh, that makes sense, you know. But and the last thing on the list is take a nap. So I always appreciated that it was on the list and it was not the first thing on the list, you know. And people feel bad. I've seen that over and over. It's like, oh, I tried opening my eyes. It didn't work. It's like, that's okay. You can get to number 15 on the list. You know, we need to approach these alternatives in a kind of lighthearted way. It's okay. You're trying to bring yourself into balance. And balance always looks different. And it's sort of a shifting state. So it's okay. Maybe you end up needing to take a nap. Or maybe you end up needing to drop the loving kindness and just be with the feeling more fully, so it's okay. Yes. Yeah. So the comment was about shifting from oneself to benefactor or friend and ending up with a line of being. So first of all, you're lucky. You know, that's pretty good. And again, it just comes back to that question of balance. For most people, we need to choose one. Otherwise, it's too jumpy, you know, and it doesn't have to feel bad because you're really transforming your own mind. So as you meet the rest of the 50 or whatever, you know, you have that. So it's really fine that it's just one. But if you feel bad, sometimes I say, we'll just have a party at the end. You know, choose one so that you get focused and you can concentrate. And then before the end of the sitting, invite the rest in and just do them as a group. It's just fine. Yeah. And someone here? Yeah. Okay, is it important to keep mindfulness and loving kindness as techniques separate from one another? Or can they sort of bleed into one another? Again, I think it a lot depends on what you see with your own mind. I mean, there are times when they bleed into one another inevitably because something comes up and you just feel compelled to do loving kindness, for example, even though you've been doing mindfulness. And so it's not like right and wrong. In general, I try to keep them separate. You know, even if it's like this portion of the sitting, I'm doing this, and this portion of the sitting, I'm doing that. Unless there is, like I said, this feeling of like a big need to switch, because that's just the tendency of my mind. As soon as I learned more than one technique, which was a long time ago, I'd find myself sitting for like a minute and a half, and I think that's not working. Let me do the other one. So I'd start the other one for like 30 seconds. I'd say, no, I'm going back. You know, and then I'd go back for like maybe another minute. I think, no, I'm going back. You know, and so it's just like, I realize my mind will just do that and that it's better for me. I'm just the kind of person who works well with structure. You know, not everybody is, but I am. And so I tend to either divide the sittings, this kind of sitting and that kind of sitting. Like I said, I don't feel imprisoned by that, you know. If I feel a real need to switch, I'll switch. But knowing that I'm likely to switch back and forth, I just try to keep it separate. Or it might be different parts of the sitting. Some people like to start a mindfulness sitting with a little loving kindness because it creates kind of a warmth and a certain atmosphere. And certainly people would tend to end a mindfulness sitting with some loving kindness because it's a bridge, you know, back into relatedness and relationship and so on. These days in my practice, I do sit every day, which I really promote, which we'll talk about this afternoon. And it's almost always a mindfulness sitting, but I have this resolve to try to do loving kindness whenever I'm waiting, and I count every mode of transportation as waiting. So walking down the streets of New York or sitting on an airplane or, you know, silently just doing loving kindness. All those times when it feels like a waste of time or such a huge hassle, I'm in this airport or whatever, I think, why not, you know, be extending this kind of energy? And it's really made it a lot of fun. So there are lots of options, you know. Switch people? Oh, you probably could set the timer every 4 minutes if you wanted. The question was about doing loving kindness on one's own, sort of knowing when to switch recipients and finding that kind of annoying. And really, you could set the timer every 4 minutes if you wanted to. I just do it intuitively, and it's, you know, I find it annoying for some reason, you know, like, but I also don't have a sense of, I really have a strong conviction that I'm doing the practice for the transfiguration of my own mind. So if I don't get to, as long as it's not someone who's compelling, you know, like who's having surgery today, then I get to them, you know, but it's all right, you know, if something happens. I don't, like sometimes people say, I'm only offering myself loving kindness. And I usually try to encourage people to do at least someone else, whether it's all beings briefly or, so even if you're largely offering yourself loving kindness, I don't think it's that good or that skillful to necessarily offer only yourself loving kindness. Because then it becomes like a project. Like, how do you know when to switch? When you love yourself fully, well, is that fully enough? You know, or like, how many minutes in a row? You know, it just becomes like this burden. And so rather than get into that, needing to measure somehow,